You may already have seen her. She's Daisy Mafubelu, who is the Assistant Director General in charge of Family and Community Health at the World Health, at the World Health Organization in Geneva. Before she took this position, she was the health attaché at the mission in Geneva for South Africa. And that was a position equivalent to a minister. Daisy Mafubelu's career in public health started at the same time that HIV was discovered, 1981. And she has served as the South African government, in the South African government in various capacities before joining the WHO. So Daisy, I hand this over to you to moderate the session. If there should be more people, this being a town hall, we opened it to the public. If more people should come and would wish to express themselves in Kiswahili, we shall allow them. And that's why I am standing here to be with my friend and sister Daisy. Thank you. Daisy, you are welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. And thank you, Florence, for that opening remark. Thank you, Pauline, for your hard work. You've been running up and down to make sure that this town hall meeting becomes a success. And it is indeed a success. And as Florence has indicated, where you have two or three people gathered together in the name of HIV and AIDS, you have a quorum. So we proceed on that basis. I wish to welcome all of you in this meeting. That brings us together, several organizations from all walks of life, to talk about something that matters most in today's world. We are here to talk face-to-face with the consumers of healthcare. We are here to see how you and I can change lives. How can we change communities? It is time for us to do a reality check. We are all here because of sexually transmitted diseases of various types, in particular the HIV infection. We need to know what can we do as women. And I'm glad to see that we not only have women, but we have men. And my brothers, you are welcome. And we're glad to have you here. Because we need you along this journey as women when we look at what we can do as women to prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS. We know that there are several technologies, interventions, and advice for prevention, which you may know that they range from abstinence to being faithful to using a condom. These work in certain situations and in certain places. But we also know the realities of the lives of women and girls. We know the realities of lives of men and boys. It is well known that consistent use of condoms can prevent sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV and AIDS. But research as well has shown that consistent use of condom is universally difficult. And it's also universally difficult to achieve with partners, regular partners. It is exactly where we need this, because there are women that are in regular partnership, that are in stable relationship. And we heard yesterday from some of the speakers at the opening ceremonies that these women can sometimes have a false sense of security, thinking that because they are in these stable relationships, because they are in a marriage, therefore they are safe. Child marriages in adolescents, it's a case in point. Young married adolescents are exposed. And they are exposed in a situation where they think they are in a faithful relationship. Sometimes they are in those relationships with older men that may have a sexual network. And therefore, it is important that women should be able to protect themselves. So women have lacked tools in the past for prevention, but we'd let that in today's world, although there are not many options, some of the options are still being developed. There are some tools, there are some technology, it is there to protect women. However, women still lack access to several things. They lack information to take appropriate decisions. And when they have information, they lack technology to act on those decisions. And if they have the technology, they lack the means to acquire the technology. And sometimes they may have all of this, but we still lack knowledge of how to use it appropriately. So in this context, the word lack, although it's a four-letter word, it describes a lot of things which affect so many lives. So some of the new technologies, such as microbicides, have the potential to be negotiated once rather than every time, such as in the use of a condom. So once we can have access to those, it's power to the women to be able to protect themselves. And not only power to the women, it's also, I think, power to men. Because at least there's something else that does not necessarily depend on them using it. Women as well can take the initiative to use that. So one could go on and on and talk about these issues. But I have people on the panel, distinguished people on the panel, that I think are well placed to discuss the specifics of these technologies and issues around female-initiated prevention. They will enlighten us of the available prevention options in the market, as well as those that are in the pipeline. They will share with us knowledge on how to be assertive and take action to protect ourselves. Because even if these methods are available, even if we know how to use them, even if we are empowered to use them to make decisions, we know how to use them, we need to be assertive and be able to insist on using them. So they will enlighten us on those areas. How can we protect ourselves? How can we protect our families? How can we protect future generations? And how can we empower ourselves to effectively advocate for prevention options that women and girls can initiate? After we've heard from our panel members, we'll have an opportunity to interact and discuss views on these female-initiated options. So I hope that you are as expectant and as eager as I am to hear what these great ladies And I must add, this great gentleman have to share with us firsthand. So allow me to then introduce the panel to you, not in any order. I would start with Deborah, who's well known, Deborah Lendi, the Deputy Executive Director of UNAIDS. She has served the United Nations in different capacities since 1978 and has experience from diverse countries such as Botswana, and most recently served as the United Nations Resident Coordinator for the Philippines before her current position. And I know that Debbie, in most of you, does not really, to most of you, doesn't really need further introduction. She's a walking testament herself to most of the things that are happening in this field. Then we have Honorable Professor Ruth Onyango, whom I had the opportunity to meet and the pleasure to meet this morning in a breakfast meeting. She's a nominated Kenyan Member of Parliament. She comes from academia, having served as a lecturer in food science and nutrition in Kenyatta University and Jomo Kenyatta University of Agriculture and Technology. She has also provided leadership to development programs, working with rural women and advocating for women's rights. We'd like to have you this morning. Dr. Valerie Manda is the Regional Director for Regional and Country Program with International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, or IAVI, in South Africa. She's a microbiologist. She comes from an academic and scientific career focusing on communicable disease control in developing countries. She has also had assignments with the United Nations undertaking responsibilities in HIV and AIDS policy and research, particularly focusing on women in Southern Africa. Then the only gentleman in the panel, Dr. Peter Okale, is the Senior Director for Health and HIV and AIDS Policy at MEP International and is a member of MEP's Global Leadership Team. Dr. Okale, a physician and theologian from Uganda, has been involved in public health since 1980. And has been specializing in reproductive health and advocacy, policy formulation, research and implementation of HIV/AIDS programs. Peter was named as one of Time Magazine's Global Health Heroes in November 2005. So it's our honor really to have the only gentleman on the panel, such a distinguished man in these areas. Then, ladies and gentlemen, we also have Reverend Josephine Ngu. I hope I'm pronouncing the last name appropriately. She's sitting amongst the audience. You're welcome. She's a pastor at the Nairobi Pentecostal Church, Woodley, serving children and women. She's in charge of HIV/AIDS issues in the church. She's also a member of the Kenya AIDS Vaccine Initiative Community Advisory Board, a teacher by training. Reverend Ngu has been involved in advocacy for HIV issues affecting children, women, and families. We have Ms. Bernice Helu from Ghana, the president of SWA, the Society for Women and AIDS in Africa, and a key advocate for women's rights and female-initiated prevention options. She has tremendous experience in women's health and reproductive health rights and HIV/AIDS advocacy and care. So we'd like to have all these people amongst us. But before I give opportunity to them to start sharing with us what they have on this issue of female-initiated prevention options, there's one special lady, a young lady that is amongst the audience, Judith Odhiambo, project assistant in UNICEF for male and PMTCT initiatives. So those, ladies and gentlemen, are our distinguished panelists that will discuss with us these female initiated prevention options so that when we leave here, we're able to change lives.
Her wonderful introduction. It's great to work alongside Daisy every day. She's one of our great international civil servants. And thank you very much for that. It's a huge honor to be here, to be in Africa again, to be in Nairobi, and to be a part of such a distinguished panel here at this historic summit. And I thank the YWCA in particular. I know it's been a lot of hard work to bring us all here today. I was asked to say a few words today about why we need female-initiated prevention methods. So I thought I'd remind us a little bit about the impact that AIDS is having on women and girls. I just came back from Eastern Europe. In the Ukraine, 70% of all new infections in that country are female. And this phenomenon we see all over the world. In Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, 60% of all people living with HIV are female. And in Kenya, where we are today, and we know that enormous efforts are being made in this country, and that overall prevalence is in fact coming down, yet for every 10 young men with HIV, there are many more young women with the virus. So it is in this context, the overall sheer enormity, numbers, let alone the human lives behind those numbers, that brings us all here together this week, and I think we must constantly remind ourselves of that reality. Before coming to UNAIDS, 2 years ago, I had the great privilege of serving as the United Nations resident coordinator in the Philippines, which is a country with very low HIV prevalence. And I got to know and became involved in supporting a group of HIV-positive women in that country to try and help them and all the problems that they had. And most of them were married, were completely faithful to their husbands, had never taken any kind of drugs, did not know very much about HIV, and never thought they would be at risk. And yet here they were in that situation. And one of the phenomena we now see around the world is spousal transmission. And in Thailand, for example, 1/3 of new infections are in marriage. So this story of women from corner to corner of our planet, we can draw some lessons from it. Women more vulnerable than men without engaging in high-risk behaviors. Secondly, our efforts to protect women and girls from HIV are simply not enough. Thirdly, women are fighting a deadly virus as well as profound inequality and inequity. So women are facing a double epidemic. Fourthly, violence against women has reached epidemic proportions around the world. So conventional prevention strategies are not helping as much as we would have hoped. Abstain, be faithful, use condoms is not a formula that is working particularly well for women. I remember when I arrived in Botswana 12 years ago to serve as the resident coordinator in that country, and you drive from the airport to the center of the city, there are huge signposts all the way along the road, or at least there were in those days, ABC, abstain, be faithful, condomize, as they used to say in Habarone. But not a formula that has been helpful, because this approach teaches that abstinence until marriage can help prevent AIDS. But we are in a world where girls are married early or forced into sexual relationships. We tell women to be faithful to their partners, but their partners are often unfaithful to them. We tell them to use condoms, but we know that their partners often refuse. Getting HIV from boyfriends or unfaithful husbands or through early marriages stem from one reality. Women and girls lack control over their bodies and their daily lives and do not have the tools or resources to change that situation. And so women need more options, the option when and with whom they have sex, to negotiate condom use with their partners, to have lives free from violence, to have enough resources to feed their families so as not to have to resort to risky situations. And this is what brings us then to the topic of our gathering, and it's a very important one today, and that is the issue of effective microbicides and female condoms, methods that women can initiate and will make a big difference for our lives. We all have a role to bring forward the day when women can have effective microbicides and better availability and use of female condoms. And here, I think it's very important to recognize that thousands of women have volunteered for clinical trials for microbicides and have accepted the female condom and its use. They've overcome fear and mistrust and have led the way for all of us, and they deserve our profound respect and thanks. I think it is everyone's hope that with several microbicide candidates in large-scale efficacy trials and a new generation of microbicide and safety studies, that they could be available on the market in a few years' time. And for female condoms, we simply must do a better job of reducing their costs and convincing everybody to use them. So today, I'm delighted that our panelists here will be giving all of us more information on where we stand with respect to these two technologies. Let me say that the international community recognizes that more resources are urgently needed to make these methods for women a reality. Partnerships among governments, the private sector, and scientists are afoot and need to be boosted. I think, as Daisy said, there are other issues that we need to worry about and must never forget about, which is access to education for girls, literacy, eliminating violence, and we need zero tolerance of violence against women, and the role of men. And as she said, it's wonderful to see that we have men here with us today to partner with all of us in terms of how we move this agenda forward. Just before closing, I would like to say that I am here in Nairobi this week, not only as a member of the UNAIDS family, of which Daisy is a part, but as a member of the Global Coalition on Women and AIDS, which was set up a few years ago to draw attention to the impact that AIDS is having on women and girls around the world. This is a consortium of NGOs, public-private sector partnerships, who have an advocacy function and an evidence-gathering function, because so often when we talk about the impact that violence may have in terms of increasing vulnerability to HIV, or when we talk about the relationship between property and inheritance rights and HIV, people in the world say, where is the evidence? Show us the evidence. And so we have chosen as a Global Coalition on Women to work in a number of areas to build this evidence base so that we can show these all important linkages. And thirdly, the Global Coalition works in countries and provides catalytic funding. So for example, last year we did a groundbreaking study in this very country of Kenya on the relationship and the intersection of violence against women and HIV infection. So that is what the Global Coalition on Women is all about, and we are delighted to be here. Two of our members of the Global Coalition are the International Partnerships on Microbicides and the Global Campaign on Microbicides, are members of the Global Coalition, and we actually support both of them, one also with some small amounts of money. So ladies and gentlemen, I sense that in this conference there's a sense of hope that with our individual and collective actions we can and we will and we must change the course of this epidemic. We are gathered here with a sense of huge urgency, and that this epidemic is having an absolutely unacceptable impact on women around the world, and that now is the time to act, and I hope this morning's session is a part of that crucial action. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Debbie, for sharing with us that, for reminding us conventional prevention strategies are there, but they are not always helping much, so we need to do more. Now, in doing more and in ensuring that we can prevent our children from getting infected, I'll ask Valerie to come and share with us what is it that we can do to prevent infecting children in case everything else has failed and we women end up being infected. And what about vaccines, Valerie? What can you tell us?
Oh, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Valerie Manda, and thank you, Madam Chair, Daisy, and distinguished fellow panelists and guests. I'd like to thank you and welcome you to this session. And my chair has just reminded me that I have 7 minutes in which to share with you a topic that I feel very passionately about, and which is, I think, assez complexe, kind of complicated as well. I hardly know where to start, but please stop me when I go overboard, because I could talk all day about AIDS vaccines. I will focus my talk on vaccines and not prevention of mother-to-child, and I'll just introduce in a small way how we work with the PMTCT programs. It's a great honor and pleasure for me to be here today. We say very often in our organization, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, that this is a marathon and not a sprint. And as you know, if you're marathon runners, I think we're in the home of the greatest marathon runners in the world, that it takes a lot of preparation. It's a very hard drive, and especially when no one is cheering on. And sometimes people, like today, are opting to have lunch and not come and listen to more information that is available and accessible, but it's a marathon, and we're looking towards the final goal. And our final goal, our mission at IAVI, is to develop, to ensure that there is the development of a safe, accessible, effective, preventive HIV vaccine for use throughout the world. And as I was preparing for this discussion, I sent a frantic email to Pauline. Where is she? Saying, tell me what sort of audience is this? Is it going to be young girls, and how are we going to focus such as the broad discussion to a young audience? But I'm very pleased to see that a lot of people who are in the field are here today to support this, our mission and this discussion on female-initiated preventive strategies. The YWCA, I believe, has a lot in common with the IRV. We all believe very strongly in partnerships. IRV was founded on partnerships with organizations such as World Health Organization, UNAIDS, World Bank, and many other private-public partnerships. We are a not-for-profit organization, and the focus of everything that we do is AIDS vaccines for use in the developing countries, for use in countries and in people that need the most. And this is how, probably the only way in which we differ, that the engagement in the whole process from concept to implementation includes voices such as yours today in the contribution of this whole process from concept to implementation. We believe very strongly in engaging the South from research, policy, and even up to implementation. So I'd like to believe we have a lot in common with the YWCA, except we're not young, but we probably are young, and we're not all women, so I'm very pleased that as much as we haven't engaged in this discourse on a gender-faceted approach. We have always considered the full spectrum of the population, including girls and especially girls. And I'm very pleased that we have Dr. Peter on our panel, because as much as I believe in girls, I think boys are probably just as important, and if not more important, and that when we talk about female-initiated controlled, we need to carry with each girl ahead as a boy ahead. Women have always taken the forefront, I believe, in ensuring the health of families and in vaccinations. If you recall, immunizations, for those of you who are mothers or those of you who are young children who remember, going to a clinic was something that you did with your mother or you took your children to for regular vaccinations. Under five clinics are filled with mothers and babies. We have to learn something from that, and we have to learn how to share, how to build on that particular aspect of vaccines as we go into research and development of HIV vaccines, because it's a sensitive subject. And everyone that I meet when I say I work with international AIDS vaccines, first of all says, when is a vaccine coming? And then the second thing is, it's so complicated. How do you translate? Can you tell me more about it? And it's very complicated to do so, and I will not attempt to do so with this forum. But what I will share is three broad areas in which we work, and hope that we can have a dialogue maybe later on, and if you wish to have more detailed information, that you may send me an email. And the first broad area is the research and development itself, which is the core of what we do. The core work that we're here for, and it's a finite program, is to research and develop an AIDS preventive vaccine. And we believe we have a new and innovative way of doing this. We do this differently from traditional other vaccines, such as the pneumococcal vaccine or the meningitic vaccine, or even perhaps, dare I say, the HPV vaccine, because what the model that we use has two arms. One is the socio-political arm of developing and implementing a vaccine, and the other is, of course, the research and development. So I'll start with that one. How do we differ? What do we do in research and development? What's going on right now? When is a vaccine coming? These are all questions that are very difficult to answer in this short space, but what I can tell you is that IAVI has moved forward 14 new candidate vaccines from its inception in 1996 to date in several countries. And vaccine design research, as you know, as with all other drugs, takes place through several stages. The initial stage, of course, is the idea. Scientist has an idea, a theoretical concept based on scientific knowledge, research, and takes it forward through a number of steps. The first step, of course, is in the laboratory, in a wet lab laboratory. And here we're looking at what proteins on that virus, if introduced to an HIV-negative person, would incite the body to elicit a response that would be protective. That is our research question. And in order to do this, it involves identifying the correct protein or antigen. That process in itself has taken us through, I don't know how many scientific partnerships alone in the world. There's an entire consortium right now, more than 100 scientists throughout the world working just on broadly neutralizing antibodies. These are the antibodies that we'd like to say, if I could compare, if you would allow me, a lock and key concept, that we have a door that's locked, and we want a key to open it. And when the door is opened, it would correlate to the body responding to a foreign antigen, recognition of a foreign antigen. And that key would be the one to, that lock would be the one to block the entry. It's actually the reverse. It should be locking it, but we want to unlock the puzzle. That's the paradox. Identifying broadly neutralizing antibodies is the greatest challenge I think that scientists are facing today. It's probably second only to identifying the actual antigens, the proteins themselves, that would, if given to a negative subject, would elicit that response. So there's the two arms of the equation. One is the antigen what is the antigen, the other is what is the antibody. And then finally, I'd say, what would you use to measure that the entire process has actually happened in the way that you wish it to happen? And here I really wish, Pauline, that I did have a slide, because I think I've probably caused more confusion than enlightenment right now. But let me just go on and say, that is the idea behind the entire R&D process, identifying the correct antigens that would go into a vaccine, into a bottle, and identifying in the body the exact response that we could measure to say that this actually works. And that involves clinical trials. These trials have taken place in animals already. A lot of them have passed that initial preclinical, as it's called, a preclinical phase, and are now at a clinical stage, which means that the trials are taking place in human subjects. As far as clinical trials on a global scale are concerned, there are a number of clinical trials that are taking place, and first results will probably come in 2008. To date, after 30 years of this epidemic, we only have one HIV vaccine candidate that has gone through the entire stage from concept to trial and with completed phase 3 trials in 16,000 subjects in Thailand. This is the first vaccine candidate based on the surface antigen called GP120. This, of course, didn't work. After all those years, 10 years in total, from concept to end, 16,000 volunteers, zero efficacy, zero. So based on that, the idea now is not to wait 10 years with each concept. The idea is to run in parallel a number of different concepts and develop strategies in which the whole process can be rather shortened but remain scientifically of high standards and of ethical standards. I think the second aspect of our work that I'll touch on very quickly is the policy work. And as we go forward with these parallel streams of trials that are taking place in many countries in the world, right now in South Africa there's drive to recruit almost 3,000 to 4,000 subjects onto clinical trials. Healthy, HIV, negative, young and old people, volunteers who are engaged or exposed to risk will be recruited in a drive that will see some results, preliminary results, in 2008. And in preparation for this, as much as we know that it's a long process and that following, if there were, best case scenario, a candidate that actually worked or produced some positive results, it would still take a couple of years before it goes in for licensure. It has to go through a process of review of that data and analysis to be sure that it is efficacious before it can be registered and then for it to be manufactured and be on the market. That whole process in itself would take at least 2 to 3 years. And this process involves receiving a market commitment from the private sector that they can manufacture this. Because in the first place, the reason IAVI was born is that everyone who was conducting research was conducting it from laboratories in the West. And as you know, research is often driven by donors, as programs are, by donor desires and by donor needs and whatever their mandates are. And at the time, there was very little finance for HIV vaccines. There was not much interest either, because in any case, if you developed it, you wouldn't make a profit from it as a scientist. You'd share the intellectual property. Secondly, which governments would pay? How much would it cost? And today we're struggling with HPV vaccines in that they cost much, and we're going to probably need an initiative or some drive from a number of partnerships to bring the cost down so it's accessible. Similarly, for HIV vaccines, the whole research and development program takes an enormous amount of money, enormous, and that in itself requires some sort of financial commitment. And that is what determines how much effort is put into it. So we do need more finances, we do need more funding in order to accelerate even further and bring more candidates on board and explore all these possibilities. So part of the work we do in policy is preparedness for outcomes, mapping scenarios, if we had a positive, something good comes up from the next trial that takes place, an adeno-5 vector with a construct that is based on genetic engineering. It is not any part of any replicable HIV vaccine. It is safe. It has been shown to be partially effective in animal studies, and it's now in human studies. If it did come out to be positive, meaning good results, what next? So there's a lot of policy work in that area. And in that area, we talk to governments, policymakers, partners like WHO, UNAIDS, and to yourselves to find out how do we implement it? What are the challenges of implementation? What can we learn from hepatitis B, HPV? What can we learn from ART rollout? There were many challenges in just rolling out treatment. And I think even if we had a vaccine today, we wouldn't be able to implement it because the structures are still wanting, and that we still need to focus, therefore, on health systems development and in developing policy towards that. And if it didn't work, of course, it means that we have others. And IAVI's strategy, 2005, took this into consideration. For the next 5 years up to 2010, we have a number of different constructs that we are ready to move into place if what is available, the adenovirus 5 structure, didn't work. So yes, we're going to learn by doing and also learn from HPV access. And then finally, advocacy. Advocacy is a very important part of what we do. In Southern Africa right now, we do a lot of work in communities. And I'm very proud to say that we are involved at every single level. And I've seen young boys and girls develop the most incredible plays and dramas and dances promoting clinical trial participation in places like Ubuntu in Cape Town, in places like Soweto. We had traditional healers come in recently with our board of directors, coming in to say we support the conduct of clinical trials. We will encourage members of our community to participate in clinical trials. And I'd say also where PMTCT is concerned, very briefly, that in Zambia, the clinical trial design is such that we use discordant couples. So a couple, most of the time, and especially in Zambia, because of I think there's a very strong influence on premarital counseling and through the church and through many other initiatives. Most couples go in for testing together before they get married, young couples. And we've taken advantage of this system to elicit from this population of people coming what the status is. And when one is negative and one is positive, we call that discordance in couples. And that in itself is a great cohort. It's the only cohort in the entire world that we have access to, and that we are going to be soon starting in July a phase 2 trial with a specific IRV construct that will enroll some 500 to 2,000 couples, discordant couples, to test a vaccine candidate on. And we hope that through that mechanism we will support and encourage PMTCT and PMTCT Plus, and we leave that to our other partners. So I think it's a whole lot of stuff to say in one, but may I just conclude in saying that we support a comprehensive and holistic programming. I personally support futuristic thinking and mindset. I believe strongly that we have a lot of challenges still in front of us on just basic prevention. Last year alone, 4 million people died from HIV and AIDS. And this is despite the billions of dollars that are pumped into prevention and treatment. And for every one person that goes onto treatment, 7 more are infected. So we're running a marathon backwards, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sad to say. It does sometimes feel that we're running and not winning. And the key, of course, is women. Women have the greatest chance and opportunity to influence change, and so do men. But we do need to speak up, and we do need to spread the word. And I cannot believe that an organization such as, for example, the Girl Guides, with 10 million young girls on board, can still say that women are left behind and girls are not, you know, they're not receiving prevention. We need them to have some action. We need more people on the ground doing, and not only saying, but doing what we need to do. We need more people going in for testing. We need more people, especially girls, going in for pap smears. And everything that is written in documentation needs to be practiced. And I'm disappointed sometimes that even active members on our community advisory boards, with all the knowledge that we share, still come back and convert and become positive in front of our faces as we are talking about these efforts. So it means something is missing. What are these social drivers? As much as I'm a scientist, I'm a simple woman, I'm a young woman, I'm part of the YWCA, my career starts with Girl Guides, and I think we still need to do more. We're not doing enough. Personally, I think I can challenge all of us here, how many of us have taken a test this year? It doesn't have to be maybe one. And two, I haven't had my test this year. How many of us have taken a test this year? How many of us have gone for a pap smear? Madam Chair and distinguished guests, I challenge you in your work to practice what we all preach. Let's all go for tests. Let's encourage others to go for tests. Let's go for pap smears. Let's encourage our daughters. Let's talk to our families. Can we sit down with our families and also have scenario setting? What if you were positive today? What are we going to do? How can we plan for this? Simple solutions, as well as the more sophisticated solutions, are what we need. Microbicides, you'll hear more about it. We're looking forward to results. We support other preventive technology. We support all new prevention, new and old prevention technologies that are available. We support treatment in a holistic manner. And then finally, I'd just like to thank all the organizers for this opportunity. And I think it's been a wonderful occasion for me to concentrate for once on a female initiated and controlled. IAVI has not put women in a separate bracket. Women and girls are there right at the top with boys and men. And as a girl, a woman, and a mother to a son, I am proud to say that I believe that women are already in the front. I do believe women are already in the front. And I think it's a question of recognition. And my dream is to not have to separate women and men and to say this is a female initiated and controlled. That men should be just as concerned as women about women's issues. And gender need not be about women, but about women and men together, focusing on whatever weaknesses are still existing in our social structures. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Valerie, for your passionate presentation, and my apologies that I've robbed the audience of hearing more of what you have to offer. Unfortunately, we don't have much time, but we need to give the people time to interact, and I'm sure that Valerie will also share in the open session if there are any questions that will come up. And In one way, I'm glad that something is happening. So therefore, in terms of vaccines, that we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm very hopeful that that light at the end of the tunnel is not an oncoming train that is coming to crush us, but it's light, real light, that will bring hope to so many people in terms of vaccines. Now, whilst we know that vaccines are still way off, what else is there currently to help us? We do have cervical barriers, microbicides, female and male condoms. I'll now invite Pauline to tell us more about this. Pauline works with the Global Campaign for Microbicides as a community trainer and facilitator. She's from Kenya. She works with the African partners to strengthen partnership between communities and microbicide research teams. She has been involved in HIV and AIDS advocacy, policy and capacity building for civil society. And most of all, ladies and gentlemen, she's been the force behind bringing you together in this town hall. So welcome, Pauline.
Thank you, Daisy. Good afternoon. Habari zenu?
Yeah, I cannot talk alone. I need to interact with people. That's why I'm a community trainer and facilitator. I want to call upon Bernice to come and join me because women don't normally walk alone. They walk together when they go to the river and when they go to the market. So I want her to stand right next to me so that I can do what I have to do. Bernice is from Ghana, and I want her to give us the section on female condoms. So that I only talk about microbicides and cervical barriers. Then I can touch on male condoms. We want to try to make male condoms female initiated too. That's why we're going to talk about male condoms. So I'll start off by talking about cervical barriers. This is very old technology. It's not new technology. But we're looking at making it be perceived as new technology so that people can use it because we love new. Even when we go to the shop, what is the newest design? That's what we want. So we love new, we'll make old technology new technology. What are these cervical barriers? These include things like diaphragms. Those things are very old. They are some of the oldest contraceptions that we know, that we used, our mothers used. Then we said, we don't want them. We want something new. So they are inexpensive. They are cheap because you can have a diaphragm for 2 years before you throw it away. You can clean it. You can reuse it. You can use it for a long time. You can put it in and then remove it. So it makes it really cheap even for a woman who doesn't have much resources because she'll only need to clean it well and keep it well. And it comes with a good packaging. There are other types, and they are in variations. It's not just one design of a cervical barrier. They are cervical cups, they're smaller. Some of them have a place where you hold so that you can remove them. But all these work towards protecting the uppermost part of the vaginal canal. That is the entrance to the womb. That is what we call the cervix. I remember Florence asking, what is the cervix and where is this cervix? That's why they are called cervical barriers. So don't be intimidated by cervical barriers as a word, but it just means you're covering that top part. Why do we need to cover that top part of the woman's reproductive organs? It's because it is very delicate. It is not made for very strong bacteria, very strong microbes to go up there. It's made so that it covers the entrance to the womb, and it has a lot of cells. I hate to use this kind of language, but I have to. But it has cells that are prone to infection. So infection is likely to happen up there than the outer side. I think the outer side was made to be punished. Don't you think so? Yeah, that's why we have vaginal sex. These gadgets were mainly used for family planning, but now we want to use them for HIV prevention. We want to combine them with microbicides. That's why the next thing I'll talk about is microbicides. What are these microbicides? Microbicides are very simply substances or products that you apply in your vagina and possibly through the rectum so that you can protect yourself against HIV infection or infection with other sexually transmitted diseases. They are not yet available. They are under research. And that research requires women to participate. They most probably will come in form of gels. What is currently being tested is in form of gels. Like many of us are familiar with spermicides, so they are most likely going to look like that. They can also be coming in form of creams that you apply in the vagina. When you suffer from candida, the first thing that the doctor prescribes is, go and apply this cream in a tube. So we are not too strangers to that cream. They'll come in form of sponges, vaginal sponges, loaded with their microbicide will be loaded into that sponge, which is also a form of a cervical barrier, and pushed into the vaginal canal. They'll also be in form of a ring, a vaginal ring that you go to your doctor, they insert that ring, it rests at the uppermost part of your vagina, and it stays there, it lets the drug get into your system slowly by slowly and protect you. But they should only exist within the vagina. The research is looking at they shouldn't go into the rest of the body because what would that mean? Research is happening in African countries. Research is happening in developing countries. And that makes things complicated because it means it's targeting women who many times don't have many choices. That's why the bulk of HIV infection is within these countries. Some of the countries in which research is happening for microbicides is like South Africa, Uganda, which is neighboring, Tanzania. Preparations are underway to start here in Kenya, Nigeria, and many others. I think just this for purposes of giving us the picture of where we are in terms of microbicide research. We shouldn't think that it's happening out there far away, but it's really happening close to us, especially for us who come from this part of the world. But it's also happening in developed countries, studies in the US, in Europe, in Asia. So it's actually a global effort because it's women who are saying we need more protection, we need more devices. The challenge of these trials for microbicides is that they enroll or they require participation of healthy HIV negative women. And HIV AIDS is related to stigma. HIV AIDS is loaded with fear. So before a woman can take a step and say, I want to participate in that research, they are really brave women. But many times we also don't recognize that, oh, these women, they are really brave. We just take it for granted. Oh, people are participating. Okay. What does that mean for them? They require support. We need to provide more services. As friends, as families, we need to encourage them as opposed to discouraging them and asking them, don't you think that you might end up with something really bad happening to you? Because that happens. So we need to encourage these women. As women, we need to talk with them. We need to give them more information. We need to organize programs that support them. What if when they go for this research, they are found to be HIV positive even before they can start off the research? What happens to them? So those are some of the things that we need to deal with when we are talking about microbicides. Another challenge that faces microbicides is there is not enough resources invested in doing research. And two, there are very little resources invested in doing community education, community advocacy, so that even before people go into a research center, they know, why are we going here? Or even, where should we go to seek any other service in case we found we needed more services? So more funding is needed to target women, to educate women, to do advocacy, to do community work. The other worry about microbicides, when they will become available, how expensive will they be? All this, the reason why I'm pulling them out is because they require the voice of women. They require the voice of grassroots organizations to push governments, to push donors, to put resources into research for microbicides and support services that go along with research. I will let Bernice handle female condom, but before she says something, let me just say one or two points about male condoms. Their use is mainly dependent on men. That's a huge disadvantage. But the one thing I would like to ask us to keep on thinking and looking for ways is, how do we develop skills for negotiations? Because if we as women don't have skills for negotiating with the men that are in our lives, we may not be able to use a male condom. We may not be able to use a female condom. It may become difficult to use a microbicide. It might also become difficult to use any other female-initiated prevention tool. So we need to develop skills. And I think we need to develop skills not just for women who are in relationships or who are older, but also to work with younger women and girls as early as we can so that they develop these skills. I'll leave it at that so that Dennis can say something about female condom.
Yes, thank you. I also require that you stand here while I talk for all the time. thank you very much for the opportunity. And I'm just going to talk about something that we've all might have heard about or may have seen or may even have used earlier on or before. Can I see by the show of hands those who have seen the female condom so that I don't spend my time going back to it? Okay. Yeah, that is very good indeed. What this means is that knowledge about female condoms is very high, and almost everybody here, and I'm sure also in the larger community, have some information about its use. Unfortunately, despite the knowledge and despite the fact that we know that a lot of women really accept the female condom, its use has been very problematic. And this is what I call the conspiracy against the use of the female condoms. Conspiracy in the sense that we've never had a consistent and dependable approach to promoting the device. In some areas where women have been trained, the condoms are not available. In Nigeria, recently, our organization, Society for Women and AIDS in Africa, sent me an SOS message saying that we have trained so many women in the use of the female condoms. They are ready to use them, but where are the condoms? Can you send some over from Ghana? Meanwhile, in Ghana, some of the condoms were stuck in the offices of some bureaucrats and some donors. One donor sent a message to me and said, "Dennis, can you quickly take this out of my office?" Because they were getting expired, they were not used for their intended purposes. So all over the place, people are conspiring to mitigate the work that we're doing to promote the device. Apart from that, we also have a lot of concerns from many sectors, which is known to all of us. Some people talk about the aesthetic values, that it doesn't look attractive, that it makes noise, that it smells, and anything that will really put them off from its use are the things that we hear them saying. Additionally, we have this issue of patriarchy. In fact, in the African homes, the men are the policy makers. They make a policy that there is no way you're going to use the condoms, and that is it. So we have to grapple also with male involved, men in particular, and especially patriarchy. There have also been issues raised about women's inability to negotiate for the use of the device, which Pauline has alluded to already. But this is something that I'll be talking about in the course of the presentation. Cost is also another issue. Most of us argue that why should a device for a rural woman be more expensive than the male condom? In my country, the cost of the female condom is 2 times that of the male condom. This is really unacceptable, and we have to talk about that as well. However, we can overcome some of these challenges, you know, which I would also describe as denial. We are in denial because some of these things can be overcome. We can train more women in the use of the condoms, and training must go with accessibility. When we train, the condoms have to be accessible. So you don't train and go away for a year and come back to bring the condoms. Or you don't have the condoms, and then you don't have funds to train the people. Let me be blunt over here. Recently in Ghana, I had a call from the UNFPA office saying they've taken delivery of a load of female condoms, which my organization is expected to promote. And then I asked for the condoms for wives. And we have a lot of satisfied users over the place who are ready to motivate other people. So we should not just dismiss the device, saying that it is unacceptable, when we have not tried our hands at a consistent promotion. Consistent means it should be out there all the time. It must be associated with capacity building. we should also ensure that our women are using local negotiation skills. It happens, I get frustrated when we sometimes dismiss our local women, saying that they do not have any negotiation skills. They do. In the local communities, we know how to get the men to buy us a Christmas cloth, don't we? We don't have to say it is right, everybody's seasoning it and blah, blah, blah. It is through the stomach. We know how to cook the best meal. We know how to tell the men, and they do what we want. So let's document those ones and build upon them and use them for our women to really have access to the condoms. Also, my suggestion goes to the fact that we should also try with the younger generation, the younger women, those in the high schools, those in the tertiary institutions, should be targeted in special programs. That way, when they grow up and go into marriage, they already have this culture with them, so they would be able to negotiate properly even in marriage. And as we know, marriage is now becoming a risky business. But when we try earlier on, when the people are younger, when the women are younger, then they would grow with this culture. I must end by just saying what a woman, an Indian woman, who was asked to talk about female condoms or promote condom using her marriage because her husband was unfaithful, said. She said, how can I start talking about condoms when I had never done that before? So what I'm saying is that let's start with the younger generation, and then they will grow up to promote it. That does not mean that we should also not work with the older women. And so I want to appeal to all other people here that we must not lose hope in promoting the female condom as we wait for the microbicide and other prevention options. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bernice. Thank you, Pauline, for sharing the cervical barriers with us. I thought when Bernice asked how many people have seen a female condom, her next question will be, how many of you know how to use it? Because obviously, if you're registered for the conference across the street, you must have seen a female condom in your bag. So the answer to that question would have been almost 100%, but I think it's important, and I think later on she referred to that, how many of you know how to use it? How many have used it? Maybe not necessarily for you to use it, but you are here as people that are going to advocate, are going to teach people. How are you going to explain to a woman how it's supposed to be used if you don't know how to use it? So I think it's a challenge for us. When we leave here, we need to scrape in our bags, look for that female condom, make sure we know how to use it so that we have power in our hands. So thank you, Pauline. Thank you, Bernice. Now I will ask Dr. Peter to share with us the current scenario in Kenya, but not only in Kenya, in sub-Saharan Africa. What is the current scenario? What can a male tell us about female-initiated and controlled options? And we've just heard that, by the way, male condoms as well can be female-initiated. So please, sir.
Thank you. Presiding Chairperson and Moderator, Dr. Daisy Makubelo, distinguished panelists seated here with me in front, the YWCA staff and organizers of this wonderful event, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I am feeling a little intimidated. I am not normally in this kind of scenarios. Maybe that's why I was given the topic scenarios. to talk about what is happening in Kenya and also what is happening in Africa. But Madam Moderator, even before I begin to talk about some of the things that are on these few pages, some of you already picked up the notes as you are coming in, I want to say that my heart goes out to women. As I speak with you, my sister-in-law, who is sick, positive with HIV, has been finding it hard to take medication. And she is not just simply refusing to cooperate, but because the virus has affected her brain. So for most of the relatives who are trying to work with her, to encourage her to take the medication, they interpreted that as being stubborn, not cooperative, hence the need for all of the things that we are hearing here and the work of every one of us to put hands together so that we work as a team, scientists, activists, theologians, leaders, men, women. Men make a difference. I think that was one of the topics for World AIDS Day 2003-2004. And it's important that we are now highlighting what ladies ought to be doing and what all of us ought to be doing to support them. I have three ladies that I want to point out, and one of them is here. If she doesn't mind standing up, Mrs. Esther Nderitu, please could you stand up? Esther Nderitu has her own organization at Ngong. She's a graduate of St. Paul's United Theological College with a master's degree in community care and HIV and AIDS, supported by MAP International and the University of Wales, and of course implemented at St. Paul's. She's my hero. Give her a hand clap. She's Kenyan. The other two ladies are Kenyan too, Reverend Mary Kinoti. I don't know if she was able to come, maybe not. She's been leading worship, those of you who know her, a little small in body, but when she begins to speak and talk about HIV and AIDS and train men and pastors, she's very powerful. Another hand clap for Reverend Mary Kinoti. And of course, Professor Miriam Were, one of our trailblazers. All of you, maybe most of you, have met her, but she's not here with us. Professor Miriam Were received an award, is it yesterday? She's chairman of NAC, chairperson of NAC, or chairman of NAC. She prefers to be called chairman. And also chair of AMREF and on the board of MAP International, Medical Assistance Programs, the organization for which I work. And she travels to the U.S. severally to attend board meetings over there. Another hand clap for Professor Miriam Were. I have other friends like Florence and so on, who will clap for you next time, but don't mind. When we talk about prevention, there are two key issues that come to mind. Are we talking about reducing risk, or are we talking about eliminating risk? If you are talking about reducing risk, the approach that you will take will of course move you towards those things that reduce the risk. But because you are talking about lives that are so precious, lives of our mothers, sisters, daughters, lives of men, women, boys, I think we need to be going beyond reducing and focus on eliminating risk. Why focus on female-initiated prevention options? I was at a meeting in Abuja in December 2005 where Dr. Joy Ezeilo presented what I thought was a justification. And as I've been listening also to our sister Deborah Landy, she's talked about the executive director of UNAIDS, she's also focused on why we should focus on female-initiated options. Number one, particularities and specificities with regard to women and girls. Stereotypes that are out there. Women are supposed to serve men. They're supposed to be submissive and so on and so forth. Keep your marriage at all costs because you wedded in church. Whether the husband is marauding outside there and you're not sure what he's doing and bringing home, stick to him. Men can have extra affairs, but not women. STIs are perceived by many as women's diseases, and even women sometimes believe that themselves. Access to information is slanted against women. We've heard from many other presenters the ABC model is not helping women to avoid contracting HIV. Why are Sentinel surveys focused only on women? So that when we assess the prevalence of HIV and AIDS, for example, in Kenya, we are talking about taking tests of women who go to antenatal aged between 15 and 49. And then we deduce, as far as Kenya, Uganda, Ghana is concerned, this is the prevalence. What about the girls less than 15 years? What about those older than 50 years? What about the men and so on? No ART follow-up after VCT, especially when we are talking about prevention, mother-to-child transmission. The mothers who we are trying to prevent passing the infection to the unborn babies and so on, are they on mandatory treatment themselves? Then there are issues with public policy, violence against women, poverty, legislation, numerous gaps between policies and laws. Dr. Ezeilo said, justice delayed is justice denied. When it comes to especially rape, incest, and those other kinds of vices which men inflict on women. So as we talk about prevention scenarios in Kenya, I'm excited about the role that Professor Miriam Were is playing at the national level and beyond. You have the notes, you can read through some of the things that I have said there. But in Kenya, they have coined an acronym TOWA, T-O-W-A, Total War on AIDS, involving men, women, boys and girls, and everybody else. So you spell TOWA with a capital T and O, Total War on AIDS, and then a capital W and a capital A. Right now, as we speak, of the 270,000 plus Kenyans who need ART, only about 146,000-145,000 are receiving. That's about half of those who need it. So we are not doing a good job. We are moving, but I think the speed is slower than the speed of the virus. What are some of the emerging issues in Kenya with respect to prevention of AIDS, HIV? Behavior change communication. How do we coordinate and sustain the gains that we have made? How do we get men involved in prevention of mother-to-child transmission? How do we accelerate the uptake and provision of ART? We are promoting female-initiated options. But as we talk about these options, who is our audience? If it's only women, then we are missing out, because we have said Africa is a patriarchal society. So the more men, the more boys that we also have in some of our audience groups that we address, the better for all of us. Protect the rights of people who are infected and affected. Accelerate mitigation of socioeconomic impact of HIV. In Kenya, there is lots of debate about the condom. And for those of you who are here, this is a newspaper cutting, the Standard of Friday, June 29th. Catholics, AIDS Council clash over condoms. Those of you who are Kenyan, how many of you saw that particular paper? And I'm sure it has generated a lot of debate and so on. These are people at the policy level. What about the district level, the communities, the villages, the households? What are they hearing about the condom? There's still lots of debates, but all of us gathered here, of course, know condoms have a role to play in the prevention of HIV. Talking about Kenya also, What have they put into place in the strategic plan 2006 to 2010? With respect to prevention, they are targeting the following groups: the youth, sex workers, and their clients. Again, focusing on sex workers alone without focusing on their clients is just trying to solve half of the problem. Who are these clients? Where are these clients? What are they following in these meetings like this and conferences like this? Are they hearing the messages that are going on there? Or are we just putting the burden again on the commercial sex worker? Policies at the workplace, injecting drug users. Again, those of you who are here, Kenyan, you know about what is happening at the coast and how so many people are increasingly using injection. Uniformed forces. Even as we talk about rape, we talk about incest and so on, most of the police force are men. So when women take their complaints to them and so on, the speed with which they respond goes back to what we said earlier. Justice delayed is justice denied. Migrant workers. The fisher folk, people around Lake Victoria, and this doesn't apply only to Kenya, it applies to Uganda and Tanzania. The lakeside, sometimes the fishermen demanding for sex in exchange for selling fish to the women. Pastoralists, men who have sex with men, and the elderly caregivers. In sub-Saharan Africa, moving beyond Kenya, again, as you are coming in, you could have picked up a PowerPoint presentation sheet, a tale of three epidemics. Just take a look at that, or look at your neighbors, if you don't have a copy. The yellow line on my chart here represents Dakar, where the epidemic, the incidence has never gone beyond 3% prevalence. The green line represents Kampala, which is the capital of Uganda. And then the red one, it's in black and white, it's not red, it just goes upwards. It's Manzini, and Manzini is in Swaziland. Within Africa, a tale of three epidemics. Why is West Africa, in this case represented by Dakar, showing the lowest, and Manzini showing the highest? People who write books normally talk about the rise and fall of somebody. For example, Idi Amin Dada. The rise and fall of Idi Amin Dada. But as I look at this graph before us, as far as Manzini is concerned, it's not the rise and fall. It is the rise and rise of the virus or the prevalence. Why? There are so many issues that apply. I don't have time, Madam Moderator, to talk about the programming that is focused on the drivers of the epidemic. But I wanted to go to page 5, if you have the notes, as I conclude, the salient issues in preventing the spread of HIV among women and girls. And there are three of them: biology, behavior, and cultural practices. If you don't have the notes as you walk out, I think Pauline helped us to print over 100 copies. You'll find out what we have talked about with respect to biology, the behavior, and cultural practices. I want to conclude, again emphasizing also what Dr. Valerie Manda has already mentioned, with respect to knowing your status. So I have put a question there. Hope you know, but you actually know your status, your partner, your risk, and other risk factors that could make you contract HIV. In conclusion, I want to say, Madam Chair, AIDS is not over until it is over for everyone, men, women, boys, and girls. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much indeed for raising those salient points, and I'm sure as invited, if you don't have the handouts. They are there somewhere outside as you come into this room on the table. Dr. Peter has really highlighted those issues which I think are quite important, and also coming from a man, we hope that you are one of our advocates out there and you can get more and more men to join us in this fight. So ladies and gentlemen, they normally say save best for last. We haven't really reached the end, but we are towards the end. And at this point, I would like to invite Honorable Professor Ruth Onyango, who is our guest of honor, to give us a few remarks. And we know that you are very committed out there, and your job is that kind of a job that makes you get in contact with people on the ground. So what are you telling these people when you meet them? Please tell us.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everybody, because you haven't had lunch. distinguished ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to be with you right now. And really, most of it has been said by really these very excellent presentations. When Pauline asked me whether she could send me a paper to read, I don't like reading other people's written papers, but at the same time, this issue is so close to my heart that I know everything I want to say from the heart, and it's all here. None of what you have said here is relevant where I operate at the village level. Nothing. Nobody knows about those female condoms, although I have gotten one in the past, tried to use it, and it was like a nightmare. But like Daisy there said, maybe negotiating, patience. You need to understand the cultural context in which you're operating. I don't know what patience there is in the community that I come from for negotiation to have sex. It's not even love making, it's to have sex. And my heart gets filled with the tears. When a woman comes to my home, she has lost her husband. She's not sure whether she's positive or negative. She's being accused of having killed that husband. And she's being bundled out of her home so that the relatives can take the land or whatever was left by the husband. When a woman comes and her children, and they say, my husband has been living in Nairobi all these years. He's never come home for 5 years. We hear the woman he used to live with has died, and died of this big disease. And I don't know how to say no to him. When a chief, who is supposed to be safeguarding the people, is known to be positive, rumor has it, and he's busy going around raping, but because he's a chief, nobody there is touching. This is the reality, I'm telling you. This is the reality. When we still in Kenya say, what did he die of? What did she die of? I think that's big disease. We are still whispering. We are not even calling it by its name. When we have an HIV/AIDS bill in that parliament, we have a minister for health who is a woman, we still can't table that bill. "Oh, you know, Kenya statistics, prevalence has gone down." I said, "Yeah, really? Prevalence has gone down?" I'm a researcher and a statistician. I'm a professor of food science and nutrition, PhD food science and nutrition. I use statistics. But now I've become a politician also. And I know I can manipulate my statistics. As far as I'm concerned, in the community I come from, at least the Luhya community, over 3 million Kenyans, I'm not sure what has changed. A lot of money in this country, I'm sure it exceeds the GDP on HIV and AIDS. It does not reach the people I work with. When there was all this hype about male condoms, hype in my community, they used to say, "If you want to enjoy a sweet, you know a sweet which you suckle? You remove the piece of paper on top of it." They were free all over the place. I don't see them anymore. I remember convincing groups to walk around with the condoms. And they didn't want to because it would go against their church beliefs and practices. Then I started to ask them, "Any one of you tell me who has not been touched by HIV and AIDS?" Then they started to carry them around. We are saying that even the female condom, let us start with young people. I have daughters, you know. I'm a teacher of young women. AIDS has hit at the lifeline of mankind. We better accept that. How many times we sit down and talk about sex, negotiating? One of the biggest tragedies earlier on, what I heard was where a man died, his wife died, the son died, and the house help died. So the father and the son were both sleeping with the house help. When were they talking about it? You know? Until death do us part. I think only women keep repeating that. Until death do us part. It's a tragedy. You have homes who have no... You have villages which have no adults in this country. They have been wiped out. I have homes where I come from, there are 5 graves, you know. Wife, man, 3 children, all of them dead. This is current, by the way. I'm not talking of yesterday. So yes, I remember in my younger days when we were trying different methods of birth control. Condom, no good, you know. Some cream, maybe not 100%. Therefrom, injection, maybe. It saddens me. I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry. I've been working in my own community for 17 years. I'm a professor of food science and nutrition. And the whole idea was, how do we improve people's livelihoods, better nutrition, improve agricultural yields, get rid of poverty. And we used to measure our development by looking at child nutritional status. Child nutritional status for Kenya improving up to the year 2000. And thereafter, beginning to go down. Failure to thrive. Yeah? Whatever we did before has been negated by this cat. And it's like a huge elephant which we can't wrestle down. So when you talk about it in a huge forum, even in church, people just sit the way you are sitting. Feeling sorry for ourselves. How do we wrestle down this animal? So, the survey we have done. What is the biggest challenge for you, people living with HIV/AIDS, affected by? Of course, I have some funding from the Netherlands, which we are looking at children who are vulnerable and affected or infected below 8 years. The biggest challenge in those households is food. Food. And we know our latest survey is showing that people are taking their ARVs, selling them in order to buy food. Food. Our budget does not take care of food. Food prescription. We need to talk about food prescription. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm not talking about those creams to protect women. I'm talking about how women can actually survive to take care of their families and themselves. To take care of little kids who have been left. Maybe the husband has died. All of us, our immune systems are under threat. We then put up with some funding, before I became a member of parliament, put up a VZT. And they told me nobody is ever going to use those VZTs. Nobody is going to come up and declare their status. But you know, I was pleasantly surprised. I now have women who have come together. They are a group. And the only qualification to be a member of that group is that you are widowed and you have been tested and you agree to be continuously tested. They stick together so they don't have to be remarried by in-laws. You know? And they can take care of their children. Because for them, those numbers give them security. A sense of belonging somewhere. No harassment. Church. Yesterday, I just met the founder of Anarela. Anarela is this? I told him, I need this. We need this in our community. Because if we can have clergy talk about being positive, then they can also ensure that families and women are protected. Police. As members of parliament, we are entitled to have security, by the way. We can go to our next police station and we are assigned a security. They tell us they cannot test our people for HIV and AIDS because the incidence rate is so high among the armed forces. It is so high. So, what can I tell you? I'm happy that we are discussing these issues at the international level. I travel quite a bit. I talk the same way where I go. I'm aware we have many CBOs in this country, if I take the Kenyan example, who are struggling with home-based care, with issues, until they become at risk themselves. They are vulnerable themselves because they don't have the resources to deal with the problem. I know National AIDS Control Council has tried. They give about 300,000 Kenyan shillings, how many dollars that is, to groups, only once. And the rest of it is left up to you. So my appeal is this. I'm a member of parliament just by default. You know, I've been there for 4.5 years. But I used to talk like this even before, so people just assumed I was going to be a politician anyway. So advocacy is so crucial. Advocacy is so crucial. We shouldn't blame anybody. The main mode of transmitting this virus is between a woman and a man. And by nature, it is entrenched in a cultural context. You need to understand it. But for me, most importantly, let's assist people to cope at that level as research goes on at the international level or at whatever levels. We are talking of survival of a generation, that we are actually losing generations. Now our clergy are insisting that the two people before they get married must be tested. But it must be tested. So let's assume it is the man who is positive. It's the man who is positive. I can see the occasional woman. No, I can see the woman saying that even if you are positive, I love you, I'll stick with you. Let's assume it's a woman who is positive. Even if the man wanted to, his family will not allow him to marry that woman who is positive. I came because the whole issue is exciting, it's passionate, and I've also learned quite a bit, and I've seen the passion. I think we are all passionate about this. If nothing else, it's the passion which is going to get us to have a breakthrough. But as we continue to do this, believe you me, a lot of the work at the community level is going on without money. Is going on without money. Money is based here. Even what comes to Kenya is just left at the national level. Big cars driving around, good reports, statistics and so on. But we need money, some of this money which comes in the name of helping Kenyans to really go right down to where the action is so that people can have hope. Families can have hope. And I know that the minute in my own community, the minute we bring spouses together, we talk to them, they begin to understand. This message that is mostly women who are infected allows men to go around dropping this thing around. They won't be infected. It's only women who are vulnerable, but the men are not. What man would want to be infected, really? Shouldn't he be using a condom also? So yes, there may be awareness, but still a lot of myths, and fresh misinformation. Thanks a lot. I'm talking at a time when you have empty stomachs. You need to be re-energized. But I'm happy that you organized this session. And to just tell you that what I normally say is that we can't lose hope, and that each one of us, I'm sure wherever we are, because we need different strategies, so we need to look at this in different ways. And although the focus is on different ways of women protecting themselves in a technical way, for me the social protection is extremely critical, and that we need to address that as well. Thanks a lot. Enjoy the rest of your stay in Kenya.
Prof, thank you very much for bringing us back down to Mother Earth, down to reality, sharing with us what you see on a day-to-day basis on the ground, for sharing with us the challenges that you see daily. And I must say, therefore, that it's a blessing in disguise that you became a politician by default, because I think we need more of you. That will be our advocate. So another round of applause. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we are definitely running out of time. Much as I want to interact with all of you, I'm restricted in terms of time. I still have two people that I would like you to listen to, but that is after I've given you a chance to raise at least three questions, put questions to the panel, and I would like to strictly restrict that to three, and not three from one person, I'm restricting it to three people. I would like to invite also Florence to help me, so that even those of you that would like to put questions in Kiswahili must be able to do so. Florence is well known to all of you. And I know that she doesn't want me to do this, but I'll do it anyway. Florence is a pediatrician based here in Nairobi. She's in clinical practice. She's a senior consultant and policy advisor of IAVI. She's a member and past president of the Medical Women's International Association. And she's a respected advocate when it comes to health and well-being of women and children, not just here in Kenya, by the way, the world over. So there's one person already who is ready to put up a question, and Florence will help me to identify and line three people to ask those questions. So, ma'am, you have the floor. Just say who you are and ask your question, please.
Sijui kama nitaongea na Kiswahili. Is that okay? Sababu saikini naongea Kisugu na saikini. Okay. My name is Anastasia Wajiko Joroge. I'm a Kenyan from Kayore, Nairobi. I'm a HIV positive. Ambaye nilipata through kuwekwa damu wakati nilikuwa na trouble Botswana. For business, I'm a businesswoman, handicraft, and between Zimbabwe na Botswana, nilipata accident baya sana ya ajali, watu 18 wakafariki, and then nilikuwa conscious, kupelekwa hospitali, nilipewa damu, nilikuwa na HIV. I survived through the God and then through medication, lakini nigetaka kuongea habari ya sisi affected because sababu nimemshukuru our professor na wakati wote nilikuwa nampigia makofi maana ameongea ukweli na ukweli mtupu. Mimi sijamsalimia hata siku moja, lakini kile ameongea leo ni ukweli, maana hapa Kenya sisi tumetengwa. Hapa Kenya, in our country, it is different. As I say, the money or the fact, the national aid inapata haitusaidii. Na sana sana sisi tuko na organization, kama mimi niko na organization, wakati nilipojijua na nikajua hali yangu na bwanangu aka accept, tunafanya bwanangu is not affected na tunafanya sex. Na ni kwa ajili tunajisuia na nikaona nitaform organization inaitwa Excellent Way Women Affected and Infected Fighting for HIV. Wakati mimi nafanya proposal na nipeleke NAC, pesa yote inaibiwa, inachukuliwa. Na hata hii juzi Mr. Orele alipoenda, inakuwa approved, lakini we never get the money. I cannot tell the why. Na sasa mimi wale nahusika ni wa mama wale wa prostitute, bame, wivo, nikepeda niwafundishe vile wangeweza kukaa, lakini hamna pesa. Hamna, inakuliwa yote nasi, na anakuwa, nini, wanapewa na donor, where do the money go? Professor tafadhali tuulizie, hizo hiyo swali, mara hatujui, I speak it! That is only what I can say today, Kenya, even if it is going up, because of poverty, hawa mama wanajiuza miri yao, sio kupenda kwa, wakienda kwa ba, akilewa, lazima alale na mwanamume. Najua wanafanya nini. Tafadhali, hii issue Kenya, we are not going anywhere. Asante sana.
Asante sana. Thank you. If you can summarize for us.
She did mix Kiswahili and English, so I presume you got a lot of it, but she got HIV very sadly when she got she was involved in a car accident and had to be transfused. That's how she got the disease. Now she has an organization showing people how to prevent getting infection, and she's been working with the sex workers, and she wants even to teach them more. But she commended Professor very highly, as you must have picked up, for what she said, what Professor said, mainly on lack of resources. She wants to talk to you, Professor, later on, and I think that's allowed. So please get to talk to Professor.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, and thank you for being brave and really doing something for the rest of the people.
My name's David Erito. I work with the Kenya AIDS and Youth Consortium of CANCO in Kenya. One is to thank the plenary for the kind work that you had. I wanted to commend the professor for your words that the new prevention options that you have are only available maybe in Nairobi and are not maybe practical in the community. That is one. I also wanted to say that we all need male support in what you are doing. We need to work together with women, not fight with women. I'm born of a woman. I'm born of a single parent, a woman. And so we love women, married to a woman. I'm a father of a daughter. So we don't need to fight with women. We need to work together with women. And we need to seek male support, because men fight with women, not because they know, but they fight maybe because of the expectation of the community. Some communities in Kenya perceive a man who fights with a woman as a hero. So if you don't fight with a woman, or if you don't have many women out there, you are perceived differently. So I wanted to ask Professor, because I saw some other day some members of Parliament were tested. The young ones were tested of HIV/AIDS after Barack Obama. They were tested of HIV/AIDS just to keep. We thought maybe if the HIV/AIDS Prevention and Control Act was assented by the president that year of December 2006, therefore becoming an act of parliament. Now the issue is, in the act itself, it indicates that the act will only commence and therefore become operational once the minister gives it a commencement date. So I'm requesting you to talk to the other members of parliament to maybe request this minister to give this act a commencement date. Because what is lacking now is a commencement date, which we don't have. The act was passed in December. Now we are still waiting 6 months later. So if you do that, you save us a lot. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Before I allow further questions, I would like to first ask Judith Odhiambo to briefly just share with us her experiences. I think it's important that we take this question at this point in time, because it might allow you to interact even more. Judith, please.
I've just been told to speak for 2 minutes. I hope I'll manage. My name is Judith Odhiambo. I'm a project assistant with UNICEF. We were implementing the Male Plus PMCC initiative. Before I say anything, I would like to acknowledge Mrs. Nifedet Mason. She's really been a pillar in my life. Nice. I'm 25 years old. I just cleared my undergraduate degree last month. I am HIV positive. I've been positive for 4 years, And I was told to share my experience in prevention as a person living HIV and AIDS. Okay. So I will say every woman, whether HIV positive, negative, young or old, we experience problems when it comes to negotiation with the use of condoms, in especially in our African setup. And most of the methods I know as a PLWHA is the female condom and the male condom. I once tried the female condom. The lady said, you can try and you can manage, but I'll say the female condom is not an easy object, especially for the first time. It's a headache wearing it. And the fact that you have to wait for some few minutes for it to conform to your body, and then when it comes to penetration, it's not also an issue, the noise and all that. But I hope with advocacy, we can be able to learn and to conform to it. And then the male condom, you know, we are HIV positive. We have feelings. We want to be in relationships. But one challenge you experience, you can't go telling everyone, hey, I'm HIV positive. You know your status. You want to protect yourself. Obviously, you don't want to be rejected. But you can't tell everybody, hey, I am HIV positive. I can easily tell somebody, but not my sisters who are HIV positive outside them. And they also want, they're sexually active. And any young person wants to have sex anytime. So we have a problem convincing men to use condoms. They will tell you, hey, I mean, you look beautiful. I mean, I don't see any sign of you being HIV positive. So why should I use this condom? I've known you maybe for 2 months, and I've not seen you being sick. So let's just do it. And you try to convince them, you know. And I'm sure there's some ladies who will say, fine, let's just do it. But if they, you know, at the back of the mind, like, oh my goodness, maybe he has added me a virus, or I've infected him. You see? Then, also, there's some men who don't know how to store the condom, you know. They put it in their wallet, they sit on it, the friction. And then when it comes to the moment, they remove it, and that's what they want to use. They tell them, hey, I have mine, please. I can't use this one. I mean, I can see it's torn or something. I mean, they'll tell you, like, this is what I want to use. So those are some of the challenges we experience. And then we obviously know African men. They'll tell you, I cannot eat a sweet with that packet, you know. We find it very hard, even us who are women, very young and beautiful, you know, to tell these men, come on, hey, I'm trying to protect you. We already know I have HIV, so I'm trying to protect you, but they can never, you know, most men, and believe me, no. I remember one time we were in a hostess club, and this lady was saying she knew her status, and then she went home and told her husband, I've been diagnosed and I'm HIV positive, and the doctor has told me ABCD. And one of the A's is like, we have to use a condom. And the man told her, that one is your virus. You don't even see it. I don't know where you got it from, but you're my wife, I pay dowry, and I have to eat this thing the way it's supposed to be, you know? So, as women living with HIV and AIDS, we really experience problems. As much as we want to protect ourselves and protect those men who may know their status or may not know their status, but at times it comes to a time you have to say it's an individual. I don't want reinfection, and so it's an individual decision. Either I will use a condom or I will not use a condom. But I think when I heard about the microbicide, I've been excited about it, because I will say this is one method that women will be able to have control over. I know when the microbicide will be out there, I'll be able to use it, and I'll not have to tell every man out there I'm HIV positive and you have to wear this thing or ABC. I'll have control over my sexuality, I'll have control over my life, my health, and I'll be able to protect them with or without them knowing. So I will really, really, I'm so excited and really encourage the development of the microbicide to be accelerated, so that women outside there can be able to protect themselves and protect those around them. But one thing we have to remember, we need to empower women. We really need to educate women around issues of sexuality and HIV and AIDS. And not just empowering them, we also need to build them, you know, the issues around capacity building. They need to be economically able, you know. Those women who you see sleeping outside there with men, it's not their choice. It's because maybe they're not economically able, and that's why they're doing that. So it's not about just building, developing microbicides. We also need to, you know, capacity building, resource generation methods, so that women can be able to have their own means. You know, they can be economically independent. So I will say it's really sad. I'll conclude by saying that it's really sad that at this time and age, people are still dying of HIV and AIDS. It's not acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you, young and beautiful.
Yeah, I want to make a plea to say really I'm now out of time completely. So I would like to request that you reserve your questions and request my panel if they would be kind enough to stick around so that there could be interaction with the panel. I know that there are a number of questions that you'd like to ask. So I would request that you do so, please. And the last person that I will ask now to also share with us, Josephine, I've introduced you at the beginning, the young women's perspective on female prevention options, just to share with us very briefly. Thank you.
Thank you so much, the moderator and all protocol observed. Indeed, it's a privilege to share with you what I have today, and I'll be talking from a young woman's perspective. Having worked with young people, working currently with children and women, and mainly women living with HIV and AIDS in the church, I'm so convinced that this meeting would not have come at a better time than today. The present status is that over 60% population of the world population is young, and over a half of these are female. It is common knowledge that this is the age bearing. It's the age that is forming families and giving birth to children. And therefore, unless something is done, we are going to pass on the pandemic. I believe that this meeting addresses a very pertinent situation, very pertinent issues that affect young women in relation to HIV and AIDS. And therefore, what can a young woman do? As young women, we can do many things. And I'll just mention a few. I'd call upon us young women to uphold morality, and I mean behavior change, such as abstinence and fidelity, as one measure to control the spread of the pandemic. I also call upon us to unite with other young women to exert a positive influence, especially on peers. I also would ask us to exercise the right of speech, we have a mouth. And somebody has said that even though it is so difficult to negotiate on sex in the African situation, a woman will definitely know how to go about an issue that is important to her. Let us be open to know and use the already available methods for further prevention of the infections, and especially the condom, which is already an issue of discussion, as we await other methods to be invented. We can also seek for knowledge on HIV and AIDS by all means. Some of us young women are very ignorant on issues of HIV and AIDS. We need to leave this bracket. Let's also avoid the old age cultural practices that disadvantage women, as we have already heard. Let us trust one another to speak for one another, and let us hold together to move from what is past and to move forward. We also need to acquire necessary education and join micro-enterprise schemes that we are equipped with skills and empowered not to be taken advantage of because of our financial needs. Young ladies, let us be involved in presently going on campaigns, especially those for research and looking for a cure for HIV and AIDS. My appeal on behalf of the young women to us that are here today and to this meeting, and to all that can hear the cry of a young woman, is one, please recognize that young women have special needs. We already know that women have very special needs, much more a young woman. I also appeal that young women will be empowered, and as stakeholders, that would be invited to participate in response to the issues that are already so disturbing concerning HIV and AIDS. Young women need to be listened to. So I'm asking that we can be heard, and that we can also learn to be given, or the older women and men can learn to give us an hearing, because we have something we can contribute towards the already ongoing debate. Please protect and promote the rights of the young women. Ask them to come in and take part in the already going research. Encourage them and ensure that after taking part, you will not be punished or thrown out of their homes for having done such an important thing. And on behalf of the young women, I would also like to appeal that there can be investing on of resources on more methods that women can initiate on. These methods would also be more useful if well accompanied by the relevant information. We appeal for preventive measures.